If you have your Bibles tonight, let's open them to the book of Revelation. Surprise, surprise. Revelation chapter 17. I have shared with you that I avoided teaching or really reading and trying to understand Revelation very much for years because I had believed what everybody told me, that it was a closed book, it was a secret. It was not intended to be understood. And then how I read in the first chapter quite by chance one day, or by the direction of God, I think, that there was a blessing promised to everyone that kept the teachings of the book of Revelation. Well, I began to put two and two together, and I figured that if I was going to be blessed, I would have to keep what the book said. And how could I keep what it said if I did not understand it? So I began to add up, and I decided, say, somebody's been deceiving me. This book is meant to be understood, and I will understand it. And so I began to study and to pray from that standpoint, and the book began to open up. And I promised you when we began that we would understand all of Revelation when we finished. Now I come tonight to the 17th chapter to say that the 17th chapter is, in my opinion, the most difficult to unravel. And if there's one place I'm a little bit shaky and say, well, maybe we'll understand it, it's as we approach this study tonight. It is not easy. It is hard to be, a little bit gracious and hold back some of what you'd like to say and balance that with the boldness of saying what you think you ought to say, which we always try to do, but then with the temerity that maybe this is what it is. Because we try to unravel what is the false church, what Revelation calls the great harlot, or the great prostitute of the New Testament. And we need to be careful in our condemnation, our accusation and inference, always in prophecy. Because prophetical language is, by its very definition, veiled in imagery. And we have to say, it seems to be, it appears that. Could it be that this is? And so with that little introduction about the difficulty of the passage to unravel it at all, plus the desire to be honest and yet not go beyond what the Bible clearly says. This is by far the most difficult of the passages of Revelation, and one which we approach with fear and trembling and hope the Lord will be gracious and give us insight and understanding. The book of Revelation is divided clearly by itself for us into three sections. The angel in John, Revelation 1:19 said, or was it 20, said, write down three things: what you've seen, what is, and what will be. What you have seen was his vision of the eternal Christ. He says, write down what is, or the things that are right now. That's the condition of the churches, the seven churches of Asia Minor. That's chapter 2 and 3. Then he says, write down what shall be in the future, hereafter, and that's chapter 4 to the end. Now in chapter 4 through 19, you have the final purging of the earth. It is so rebellious that he doesn't want to rule, nor will he rule on this world system and this world as is. He will cleanse it, judge it, purge it. Then he will set up his righteous kingdom, and then he will rule here. Now this purging occurs in three or four ways. There is, first of all, the purging of rebellious, sinful man himself. We have seen that for these many chapters. And we saw, I think last week, was it not, in chapter 16, verse 17, the last three words of that verse, it is done. It is done. The seven scrolls have been unrolled. In the seventh scroll, the seven trumpets have blown. In the seventh trumpet, the seven vials or bowls of wrath have been poured out, each from the first trumpet to the last vial, with increasing force, such that the last thing that we see is absolutely unthinkable, unimaginable, inconceivable, and yet here it is. And then he finally says, it is done. It's over. Now the earth has had the second kind of judging, hasn't it? Along with man's judgment, there has been a judging of the earth. The earth has been poured out upon wrath. The rivers have turned to blood, first a third, then all of them, the oceans to blood. The skies have fallen, been snapped up like a scroll. So we have seen man judged. Then we have seen man's environment judged. Now we will, these next two Wednesday nights, tonight and next week, see two other things judged. Next week in chapter 18, we shall see the judgment of Babylon. Babylon is the principle, the system of government, religion, of government organized against God, the world system. Now tonight in chapter 17, we will see the judgment of Mystery Babylon. Mystery Babylon. Chapter 18, the judgment of Babylon. That's the government, the political system of the world organized in opposition to God. Mystery Babylon and its judgment is the judgment of the world system of religion against God. Babylon is the world system of government against God. Chapter 17 is the world system of organized religion, which is against God. And it's called Mystery Babylon. I think the inference is obvious. Something that is a mystery refers to mysticism, the ethereal, those areas in which faith exists. Faith is mysterious. It is ethereal. It is not written down in bang, bang, bang. It is not a mathematical science. It is an experience of the heart and the faith response of the soul to God, to worship Him. And so mystery does not mean as much impossible to understand hidden truth as much as it means mystical, ethereal, more intangible, and that's the area of our faith. And so hence the name Mystery Babylon, the name given to the organized system of world religion. Now it should not surprise us to find that our world, we shall see, not only historically, since Babylon and since the New Testament era, but to this very date has produced a system of world religion that is opposed to everything that is New Testament, that is grace, that is faith, that is purity, that is good, that is God. Because the sixth age of church history, the Church of the Open Door, is an age in which we have one foot, but it is a sun-setting age, and there is dawning and overlapping. We also have the other foot in the Laodicean church age. Now, the Laodicean church age, the four gleams of which is very prominent in our society, is so liberal and so apostate, so wicked and unrighteous and ungodly and unbelieving and deity-denying that it doesn't even deserve the name church. So as from Babylon to the cults and the mystics of Egypt to Constantine to the Dark Ages to the Laodicean church age, we ought not to be surprised that there is an increasing darkness of evil in religion, such that finally the final church age of false church, false religion, I think beyond the Laodicean church age, is Mystery Babylon. Now, when the rapture of the church takes place, The church is removed, the true bride. Life goes on. Church goes on. The phony, false, liberal church will still be here, and they'll be trying to laugh at it and explain it away. And the Laodicean church age then, I think, exists mostly as an overlapping to the Philadelphia church age, the age that we're in now. I think we're also in the beginning of the Laodicean church age. I think it is not long lived. It makes God sick at his stomach, because I think no more than 3.5 years into the rapture, the Laodicean church age climaxes in the most apostate church, the religion or organized system of religion the world has ever known, and that's the mystery Babylon. So it is at once the zenith of all anti-God religion in history and the incarnation of everything that has been, and gives allegiance for a while to Antichrist. But I think it's very short-lived, if as you please. And so none of these ages, you understand, start and stop with the calendar. They all fade in and fade out, phase in and phase out. So we're certainly seeing many of the rudiments in this much a part of the Laodicean church age. So cold and apostate and dead, it makes God sick at his stomach. We're seeing some of the roots of mystery Babylon. A mystery Babylon is at once the last climactic culmination of all anti-God, anti-truth religion, and the incarnation of it all, and the last final climactic brief tribulation period world religion. And as man is individually, as sinners, judged, as his environment is judged, his world polluted, his heavens rolled up like a scroll before the final judgment, when this all dissolved with fervent heat and there's a new element, a new earth, so is man's political system, which is against God, judged, and so is man's religious system. Is there any question in your mind that these things exist today? Is there any question in your mind that entertainment, that government, that education is primarily anti-God, new age, humanistic, liberal, from court to classroom, of course? And it doesn't surprise you that when nearly 70% now of the preachers who preach behind pulpits in the 270,000 North American churches, nearly 70% don't believe in the blood or the bodily resurrection, that we're in the great dawning of the close of the apostate church age, the Laodicean church age, and the beginning of the short-lived climax of all of this, religiously, of the mystery Babylon religious age. Remember, you live in the Bible Belt, and you turn on almost any radio or TV and hear a preacher, he's going to be preaching somewhere close to the truth. But you get out of a few Bible Belt states, and that's not the case. So, we believe that this mystery Babylon then is the incarnation and the culmination of all organized systems of religion that is anti-God. It is short-lived, and yet it is the incarnation of all of them. And as man is judged in the tribulation, as his environment is judged, as his government is judged, so his religion is judged. And this chapter is about the judgment of man's religion. And it's called Mystery Babylon. I want to read just a little overview here for you. Chapter 17, verse 1. And there came out of the seven angels which had the seven vials, there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, Come here, come hither. I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore or harlot or prostitute that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away into the spirit, into the wilderness, And I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns, the beast. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a gold cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration, literally amazement or marvel, not admiring as though to be honored, but amazing as to be wondered after. And the angel said unto me, why do you marvel? No mystery. I'm going to tell you, I will reveal to you, I will show you or explain to you the mystery of the woman. I'm going to explain this to you. And of the beast that carrieth her. And he does. In a moment, we'll see, which hath the 7 heads and the 10 horns. Now, with that reading, let me give you a short overview, and then we'll go back and take that apart and the rest of the chapter. I think it's too complex to get in two settings. We have seen Israel pictured as a woman in the wilderness giving birth, and that to which she gives birth is the church. And we have seen that the woman, this is all past in Revelation, is Israel, the mother of the church that gave birth to the church. Out of the teachings, the prophets, the scriptures of Israel came the church. And Jesus Christ is the message and the heartbeat of the church. He is incarnate truth. So we are not surprised to find that this false woman, this mother of untruth, gives birth to a church whose central message is untruth. Jesus is called the truth. Satan is called the lie. And so is the Antichrist, the theme, as Jesus, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are the true and our true Trinitarian heart of Christian theology. So the beast, false prophet, and Antichrist are the heart of satanic theology, are the essence of the theology of one of the false church, one of the true church. So this woman, this false woman of harlotry, gives birth to false religion, whose theme is the worship of the beast, the Antichrist, the false prophet. Now, we know several things about this woman that we shall try to identify. This false harlot. And don't jump to any conclusions, because I know what you're going to be thinking when I get into this, and I'm going to tell you that what I'm thinking is probably different from what you're thinking. We believe, as Baptists, as Protestants, when we broke off of Roman Catholicism, that there were 5 basic things, 5 tenets of Protestant faith, which are different. One of them is the separation of church and state. There is nothing as historically documented as the intertwining of church and state, religion and government, religion and kings, as is the history of Roman Catholicism. Now, we know that there are 3 or 4 characteristics of this mystery Babylon, this false religion. 1, it intermarries with the world, verse 2, whom the kings of the earth have fornicated. 2, we know that this church is covered with great riches, verse 4. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and in gold and precious stones, golden cup, pearls, unbelievable wealth, covered up with unbelievable wealth. We'll come back to all of this. 3, we know that she has been responsible for the martyr of the saints. She has killed, martyred many saints, many children of God. 4, look in verse 9. She sits upon the 7 mountains. She sits upon 7 mountains. Herein is the mind which hath wisdom. Look with wisdom at this. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. So she sits upon 7 mountains. We know the head of the Roman Catholic Church is in Rome. We know that Rome is known as the city of the seven hills. And so you think I'm not just blowing smoke. The names of those hills are Aventine, Callion, Capitoline, Esquiline, Coronal, Zeminal, and Palatine. And so you add all of this up and you say, it's obviously the Roman Catholic Church. Well, I think the answer to that is yes and no. And I'll get to the no in just a little bit. So with that little overview and introduction, let's try quickly to take this chapter apart. There came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials, not which has, present tense, they have all seven been poured out, haven't they? We saw last week that they were likely all poured out at once. So here's an angel, he had a vial, that is, he used to have this vial, he doesn't have the vial anymore, he had the vial, he's through with it. And he came over and tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey John, let's talk a little bit. He said, come over here, I'm going to show you something. I'm going to show you the judgment of the great whore, or the great harlot, or the great prostitute, whatever your version might have it, that sitteth upon the waters. He says, John, I've got something to show you. He says, here's something called the great harlot. Now, we have not been able to identify anything as a great harlot before, but we have identified this. We have identified Israel as a picture of a woman in the wilderness giving birth to the church. And so we have seen the antithesis of the true and the false repeatedly in Revelation, so we are not surprised to find now an antithesis of another kind of religious system different from Israel that is false. This one is a harlot. This is unfaithful. This one is untrue. So we would guess it is a religious system. It's going to be judged, and it's unfaithful to the truth and to God. It's called a great whore here. And it sits upon many waters. Now, we have seen repeatedly, and will again tonight. Well, let's go to verse 15. And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, we've seen this before, haven't we? Where the harlot sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. Oh, thanks. I don't even have to look up my concordance or read a commentary. Thank you, John. Thank you, angel. And so he tells him what these waters are that this great harlot sitteth upon. So the imagery is obvious. This false, glamorous, historic, great world system of religion controls vast multitudes of people. It covers many, many waters. It has persuasion and influence and control over millions and millions, perhaps even a billion or more people. It sitteth upon many waters. It presides over, influences, controls large numbers, verse 15, of people and multitudes and nations and tongues. Verse 2, with whom the waters know, the harlot, the kings, that's the political leaders, the rulers of this earth, we'd say some kings now, but politicians and presidents, ambassadors, have committed fornication. Now, how have these kings committed fornication? Obviously, it is a system, therefore it is a spiritual fornication. And obviously, if a king leads his people into true religion, it is not fornication. So here are kings of the earth who historically have not separated church and state and have intertwined the leadership of their country governmentally, politically, with this world religious system. That's the fornication, that's the spiritual involvement. And the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. What does being made drunk do to you? It makes you see things not clearly. It gets your sound reasoning off center to be inebriated. You can't tell truth from fiction. You can't tell reality from unreality. Your perception is dimmed. And so the intertwining of the leadership of this world politically and the peoples that they influence have had a lifelong running, eternity running affair here with this religious, false religious system that has blinded them from the truth and made them to see not clearly, hence the expression, drunk with the wine of her fornication. So verse number one, he says, I'm going to show you something. Verse three, he shows him something. He does what he said. So he carried me away in the spirit. I like that expression. Carried him off in the spirit. I guess his body stayed there. He took his mind and soul over here. And I saw a woman. Here was the woman. He said, I'm going to show you. Here it is. She sitteth upon a scarlet-colored beast. Let there be no question. We have seen this beast full of names of blasphemy and seven heads and ten horns, clearly as the incarnation, as the Antichrist. But he says this, that this incarnation of evil is covered over with this scarlet-colored thing that makes the beast look scarlet. Now, I want you to know that the woman sits upon the multitudes. We shall see here in a moment, in control of the king. Here she's in control of the Antichrist. So she has marvelous power. And it is her influence over all this false religion that comes through government and politics and leadership that increases toward the end of time. And the woman was arrayed. Here's another characteristic of the woman. She not only had great political power with her religion over all the world, but she was arrayed, bedecked in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. Now let me say here, my wife and I went to Israel in 1972. Some people in the church made it possible for us to go. We'd never been, and it was an awesome experience. But may I say to you that the Roman church has covered up virtually every sacred shrine in Israel with gaudiness. You go to the birthplace of Jesus. You go to where John the Baptist was supposed to have baptized Jesus. You go to the spot where Jesus was to have been born. You go to any religious historical spot, and virtually there's a shrine with millions and millions and maybe billions of dollars of jewelry and statues and pictures and diamonds and rubies that are dazzling. And you are not nearly impressed with the spot where he was born as the junk that covers it up. And I wondered why it is that some religious movements have to have such gaudiness and opulence of imagery and pictures, and proliferation of colors to dazzle the people. And I read a little book once, and a little line in it said, it is that the less light you have, the more lights you have to have. That if Jesus is the real darling, the attraction that holds a religious movement together, you don't need everything else to impress the people. But some religions, have they not, have truly gained their worldwide power in countries where there is ignorance. I look at Mexico. I look at Spain. I look at South America, the countries of the world where some religions have made unbelievable strides and have unbelievable control of the people. They thrive on their ignorance. They do not reveal the Bible to them. You know, the priest will do all the thinking for you. That's the mentality. But oh, while the millions are starving to death, the opulence in the churches. And I wondered, is it not true that the less real light you have to hold the people together, the more lights you have to have? And where Jesus is the real light, he's all that binds us together. It is not necessary to dazzle and befuddle ignorant, poor, uneducated, uninformed people with a dazzling array of other things that impress them. And I thought about some systems of world religion. Verse 5. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. So she has power with the Antichrist, power with the kings of the world, power with the waters of the people. She is covered all up with imagery and beauty and dazzling display. Another characteristic of her is that she's killed God's people. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. This is not our word for admiration, would be to respect. This means simply marvel. I wondered at such a thing. Great awe. Well, I'll just say briefly, you read any textbook of history and you look at the persecution and the martyrdom of those who have bucked this religious system, who have laid down their lives for Protestantism, and you will be shocked at the Zwinglis and the Shermans and the Lollards and the Anabaptists and a thousand, the Knoxes and the others that have paid dearly to advance the truth, give a heritage to us as Baptists and as Protestants. Been a tremendous history of martyrdom of the saints. Verse 7, and the angel said unto me, why are you standing here gawking at this? I'm going to tell you what all this means. He says, I'm going to tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries the woman. So you see, the woman is seen as in control of the beast. I want to give you a preview and tell you that this religious system that controls the political system, eventually the political system turns and destroys the religious system. We'll see that tonight. I'm going to explain this to you. I'm going to explain to you the mystery of the beast, and I'm going to explain to you the mystery of the woman. Now, that's the order that he says it here. The woman and the beast. But then he gives us the beast first, then the woman. So jump down to verse 18. No, let's not do that. Let's save that. Let's go on with the beast. Well, look, verse 18. The woman which thou sawest is that great city. So the woman is a great city. Oh, you mean it's not a religious system, it's a city? Well, put an asterisk there. We'll be back with that. But let's go to the beast. He says, now who's this beast you saw? Verse 8. The beast that thou sawest was, here's an overview of how it all happened. He was, then there's a time that he is not, then there's a time that he shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, then there's a time that he'll go back into perdition. This beast is somebody who is for a while, then he isn't anymore. He's in hell. Then he ascends out of hell for a short season. Then he's back in hell. Now, we know at the end of the tribulation that Satan is bound for a short season and cast into hell and then released for what appears to be the final battle of Gog and Magog and then cast back into hell. And he says, this beast that you saw, this is the devil, he shall come out of the bottomless pit and then go back into it. And they that dwell on earth shall wonder. I think he means those that dwell on earth when this is happening. Because here's Satan's last miraculous magic ploy to get converts. The lost people that are still here at the end of this short time, who are not written in the book of life from the fountain of the world, foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is, See, they're in awe, they're in wonder. So he gets a few short converts. Now he says, and here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Well, this may be the seven physical hills of Rome, but it may be seven other kinds of heads. It may be seven entities or periods of time that her leadership and influence over have transcended. She sat on all of them for a long time. Let's see which it might be. So maybe it's not what we've been thinking. Some of you have been thinking it might be. All right, verse 10. And there are seven kings, okay? Seven kings. Five are fallen. Let me change here. Five are fallen. And one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. Okay, so now here's seven kings. Five are fallen. What is a king? Well, a king, somebody's got a kingdom. So we're talking about seven kingdoms. Seven kingdoms have fallen. They're not anymore. Well, we have the Grecian kingdom, Persian, Assyrian, Babylonian, and Egyptian. He said, and one is, there's a kingdom which is right now, John. Right now when? Right now then. That's the Roman Empire. And he says, and the other is not yet come. It is yet in the future. But when he cometh, he must continue a short space. Well, is that Jesus' 1,000-year reign? I don't think so. We're not into the millennium here. I don't think Jesus' reign is going to be called very short. So this may be a reference to Satan's brief reign when he has free reign for the first time in history for 7-year tribulation. That's Satan's kingdom. Verse 11, but it's short. It's only 7 years. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven. So out of this seventh era comes the beast, which is the eighth. Out of Satan's kingdom era of the tribulation comes what? Satan, the revelation of the Antichrist. He's not revealed at the beginning. It is not he who introduces the tribulation. It is the tribulation which introduces him. He arises out of it. But what happens to him? He goeth into perdition. What happens to Satan at the end of his brief reign? Into hell. Verse 12, and the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet. I think we're talking about the tribulation here. We've suggested elsewhere that a revised Roman Empire, a confederation of 10 Roman entities, Daniel's vision, out of Europe, an economically, militarily, politically strong, revived European empire at the end of the time, will come the Antichrist, who will be a religious and political leader. We've been through all of that. But now, they don't have any kingdom as yet. So we're going to see 10 kings here, but they don't have a kingdom yet. But they receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Could it be that this means during the tribulation that these kings, that Antichrist is so in control of the world that they don't have any power until somewhere in the future the Antichrist control is so strong that he authorizes these 10 leaders of these 10 countries to exist. To exist as what? To exist as cooperators with him, with the only power that'll make any difference at that time. That he has demonstrated himself as a miracle worker, false miracles. He has such clout and such power that he can ordain to kings who may rule and who has power. And listen to this. They have no kingdom as yet, but they receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Can you imagine that down here on earth during the tribulation, on the newscast, they're going to say, folks, you won't believe what happened. You know our wonderful leader who's brought so much world peace? Give the Antichrist name, who's now just beginning to be revealed as Antichrist. He met today with the 10 kings of heads of state in Europe. And he authorized, they made a deal. He gave them power, and they gave him allegiance in only a one-hour conference that has changed the face of the earth. Well, they have one mind, and they shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Why would they give their allegiance to the beast? Because the beast gives his allegiance and power to them. Now, what is happening here? You're seeing a scenario of a final organized world power of Satan that is making collision and deals with the peoples of the earth's leaders. We're seeing in Ezekiel the powers of the north are going to come down. We've seen in the powers of Europe's head here, apparently, are going to join together and make collusion with the beast. We've seen the armies coming from China, 200 million strong. We've seen Zechariah's prophecy, all the nations of the world will come against Israel. So what have you got? You've got all kinds of collusion under the influence of and with the Antichrist. And now he has it all in place. For what purpose? For the battle of Armageddon. That's why the next verse says, "These shall make war with the Lamb." What does that mean? When the Lamb, Jesus, comes from heaven, the Bible says, with all his saints and all his holy angels, they will all come with him and battle over Jerusalem. Why Jerusalem? Because Jesus Christ, the angel said, is going to reign on the throne of his father David. He will reign from Jerusalem in the thousand-year era of peace. But in 2 Thessalonians 2, the Antichrist at the end of tribulation has sat down on the throne and temple and said, "No, I'm Christ, worship me." And that's where it hits the fan. And Jesus says, "Hold the phone, let's get this on. Let's settle it. Let's find out whose world this is. Who is going to reign in this world?" So Jesus and the saints come from heaven to do battle at Armageddon. And the hills around Jerusalem, with Jerusalem in the prize. As the prize, because who rules Jerusalem rules the world. That's why you've got a confederation of kings of the north, all the nations of the world coming. You've got the 200 million man army from the east. And now here's the European confederation, apparently, all in collusion with him, drawing life and power and authority from him and giving their allegiance to him. He says, they come to make war with the Lamb. And all these kings and beasts and armies and 200 million troops, they're sure going to get it, aren't they? Nah. I mean, they're sure going to beat up the Lamb, aren't they? Nah. The Lamb will overcome them. Lamb will overcome them. Paul says in 2 Thessalonians, when he comes, that Jesus will destroy them with the brightness of his coming. I wonder, I don't think there's going to be a shot fired when they look up and see Jesus, when all the armies of the world are converging on Jerusalem, and they look up and they see Jesus coming. How does the Bible say they're going to be destroyed? And Jesus will drop atom bombs, no? And every saint will have an M1, no? He will destroy them how? With the brightness of his coming. I believe the dazzling display of the white-hot Shekinah glory beauty of Jesus coming will so blind all of these armies. And the resultant confusion, I think they'll turn and shoot each other. The prophet said that the valley of Megiddo would run as deep blood. We've seen it was 70 miles wide and 200 miles, or 30 miles wide and 3 miles wide and 200 miles long, as deep as the bits in the horse's mouth, about 6 feet deep. Destroyed with the brightness of his coming. And so they're going to make war with the Lamb. Some war. The Lamb and the saints and the angels. 10 billion. Devil's armies, zip. What a game. What a contest. Why? For he is Lord of Lords. Sorry, folks, I got a cold. Lord of Lords. And he's King of Kings. And they that are with him are called chosen and faithful. We're coming back with him. And he saith unto me, the waters that you saw,
where the whore sitteth are people and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the harlot. Now get this. And shall make war, make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. That means that somewhere in collusion with the power of the Antichrist, the kings, the leaders of this empire, are going to turn and destroy the religious system. Read that again. They will hate the whore and make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. So the political system will destroy the religious system. Why? Here's why, God hath put it in their hearts to do it, to fulfill his will. That's the way he's going to destroy it. Is there any precedent for an army being blinded and chopping themselves to bits? Oh, yes. Remember Gideon? They just tooted a few toots on the cornet and swung some pitchers and hollered the sword of the Lord and Gideon. And they were so confused that while 300 stood there and watched, thousands just beat themselves to death, chopped themselves to death. The blindness of his glory will cause his enemies to chop themselves to death. And as a part of this process, the false world governmental system will turn on animosity and hate and chop the false religious system. Is there any historical precedent for secular societies turning on religion? There's nothing else, but the whole Roman Empire was set to try to stomp out the children of God. And whom did they use? Who agitated it? The Jews, who became false religion, having rejected their very own Christ when he came, and God used them to stir up the political system and nearly stamped out his church. That's why the blood of the saints ran red. Is anything less going on today? Is there not a day that goes by that some new law, some new humanistic liberal law, does not call for greater and further infringement on morality and censorship and godliness and the church? You know, I'm all for trying to get Christians elected to be governors and mayors and vote in a non-abortion rights. We need to do all we can to change the world politically through the political and governmental system. But the prophetical truth is that it won't work. Nothing's going to change. This unbelieving world will turn and its antagonism toward religion increase and eat up and destroy all religion. Of course, the true religion will be out of here in the rapture. We'll be gone. Out of here. I like that. We'll be out of here. Well, God will put his will in their heart and say, destroy them and give their kingdom unto the beast. Why does he say, give the religious system's power now to the political system, the beast, let it destroy? Because God's going to destroy the political system and its head, the Antichrist. Until the words of God shall be fulfilled. That means unto the ultimate end of, or purpose that, in order that, so that we might go, until to bring about the final conclusive act of God's judgment on the world. Then verse 18, we've already seen. Revelation 17, I left out something important. Verse 18, okay? Never a dull moment at Old First Baptist, right, folks? Never know what to expect. Okay. I told you that this is an organized system of religion, but it's not true religion. That's the woman. In verse 18, he says, the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. Well, is it a system or is it a city? Is it? Well, that depends on what the great city is. Perhaps the great city is Rome. Perhaps the great city is Jerusalem. Jerusalem is called the great city twice in the Bible. But we're in context here talking negatively about something bad and awful, the ultimate incarnation of evil religious world system. And the ultimate incarnation of all organized movements against God is called Babylon, principle of sin in the world. And the ultimate incarnation of all rebellion against God spiritually, religiously, is called Mystery Babylon. So, I think the great city here has to refer to Babylon. Now, why is Babylon the city that is referred to as the capital of evil? If, you see, if Jerusalem is where the gospel of grace flowed through and started, if Babylon is where the gospel of rebellion against God started, now watch this. If the new Jerusalem is a spiritual Jerusalem, eternal heaven, then a spiritual Babylon, a mystery Babylon, would be a spiritual city too, would it not? Therefore, I don't think the expression "that great city" refers to Rome, or I don't think it refers to Jerusalem. I think it refers to Babylon. Now, why Babylon? Why is Babylon the city that is the incarnation of rebellion against God? Because when God introduced grace into the world by saving the world through that flood in that ark, the first thing he did when man came out, he said, "Now, go into all the world and spread the good news. Tell everybody about the grace of God you revealed in this ark. Men will want to repent and be saved. Go tell them everywhere." And the first thing man did was to organize an organized system of rebellion against God and said, "We disobey." They built a tower not to try to reach God. The Tower of Babel was not to try to get to God. The Tower of Babel was to build a monument that reached into heaven to shake its hand in the face of God and said, "We're not going to do what you want us to do." God said, "I think I can handle that." And he confounded them and gave them all different languages. And they couldn't communicate. So they had to go all over the world and get alone in little groups that could talk like they do so they could build communities and culture could survive, you see. So Babylon, the noun, what shall I say, I don't want to say noun or adjective or whatever, but the word that is become a title for Babel, the city in action, is now Babylon. Therefore, Babylon, from Genesis to Revelation, is the picture of the capital of rebellion, organized world rebellion and disobedience against God. It has individual personal ramifications which are judged. It has environmental ramifications. Man's world fell along with man, which are judged. It has governmental ramifications. The government of this world is diametrically opposed against God, which is judged next week. And it has religious incarnation ramifications, which are judged. And so Babylon then becomes the personification in a city of the principle of religious defiance against God. Now, there are many things that are trying to bring the world together. There are some who say speaking in tongues, the gift of tongues, beyond Catholics, beyond Baptists, beyond Methodists, and everywhere, is the one thing that's going to bring us all together. There are those who say that it is really the most pervasive thing in religion today is apostasy, that that's what's going to bring us together. And that it is, you know, the fundamentalists of the Word of God are less and less, and the liberal theologians are more and more. There are some who say, no, that is bringing ecumenicity to religions in the world is not experiences or is not doctrine. It is social service. And so much ecumenicism of all churches together is built around social ministry and social service and social good. And those things are good. But that holds it together is a fabric of rebellion against God, independence from God, no authority, do your own thing, which is downright, purely sinful. That is the system which the Bible calls the mystery of iniquity, that is the primary spiritual atmosphere of the day just before Jesus comes, and it permeates the world. And it is the personification of Babylon. I'll do as I please. It is rebellion against the authority of God as expressed through any existential rule over him through any man or system in the world. That is the ultimate thing that binds together the apostate church. Therefore, I think that while some of the things you have identified in Roman Catholicism may give birth to that, may tend to that, I think Mystery Babylon is not a city. I think the great city is a spiritual city. That's a feeble effort to try to struggle through one of the difficult chapters. Next week, we're going to see the destruction of the political system. And then we're going to see the king come. Then we're going to see the Armageddon. Then we're going to see the new heaven and the new earth. So hang on. Business fiction to pick up. It gets better and better and better from here on. Let's stand, shall we?